feel free to ask any questions throughout this whole thing. I'll be more than happy to answer everything I can. First of all, some of the approaches I get from people is they're not aware of what the urgency is that's happening with the Hispanic culture. They just know that usually the people... Was that bong there for a reason?
No, I apologize. Continue.
Okay. So I just kind of generally go through some stats just to display the urgency at this point. Right now, the Hispanic culture for the last at least 30 years, from the research I've done, has had an incredible dropout rate in comparison to white and black students. The only group that has a higher dropout rate than the Hispanic culture right now is American Indians. But because of the numbers that it gives into society, it's quite alarming. Sometimes it's between 20 and 30% more than the Hispanics and dropouts. The other thing is the college graduation rate in 2006, according to the census, 30% of white students went on to college and got a degree. 16% of black students went on to college and got a degree, but only 10% of Hispanic students got a degree, went to college, and 50% of Asians went on to college to get a degree. So right now what we have is a whole bunch of students that are turning into adults that are continuing the cycle of poverty, continuing the cycle of not being educated, and it's just as more and more children are born into it, the numbers just become much more concerning as it is. According to research done by the Cradle to Prison Pipeline, in 2001, a Latino boy who was born into a family had a 1 in 6 lifetime risk of going to prison, and a white boy born in 2001 had a 1 in 17 lifetime risk of going to prison. A Latina girl born in 2001 had a 1 in 45 lifetime risk of going to prison, and a white girl born in 2001 had a 1 in 111 lifetime risk of going to prison. Many times what happens in the school setting is that you have students, if you're familiar with AHA's work, its original work on poverty, a bigger percentage of Hispanics are in poverty than those who are white. And so there's sometimes culture and economics gets confusing and it becomes multi-layered. So those two things seem to come as one unit when in truth they're two totally different issues. And so one confuses one for the other many times. So those are the kind of things that people need to keep in mind. Now, as far as where Hispanics come from, there are 24 different countries around the world where Spanish is either the main language or a significant language within a population of a country. Of those 24 countries, 21 of them are third world countries, and 3 of them are second world countries. So part of what we need to keep in mind is that when people come from these countries to the United States, they're generally going from a third world country setting to a first world country or a very advanced technological country. And that's very different from people who come from the United States and inverse go visit those countries. When you have people transmigrating, either for vacations or for a living situation, it's a very different format of travel. And so many Americans don't understand why or how people are at such a disadvantage within traveling, because generally when Americans go to another country, coming from such a strong economic base and understanding and technology, they have the upper hand when it comes to touring, asking questions, you know, finding out about history. When you come from a third world country and you're lacking in education, not that everybody in those countries is not educated, that's not true, and we'll get more into that in a minute. But generally, when you have people from a third world country visiting the United States, there's a lot of, I don't know what questions to ask. I don't understand what's in front of me. I don't know how to negotiate commerce. And when you also come from poverty, then you discern your environment so differently from middle class. And in many third world countries, there is no such thing as a middle class. You, you either are in poverty or you are in wealth, and the in-between part really does not exist within a political or social structure. So those things are also extremely different. Now, the workshop that I give on this is based on patterns, and you know, all patterns have exceptions. This is not about, please don't take anything I'm saying as the absolute truth for all Hispanics. That would be, you know, like saying that the students that I work with are predominantly minority and in poverty as well. And when I work with minority students who are in poverty, the stereotypical line that they'll give me is that all white people are rich. And so it's that one blanket application that can be either offensive or comical or whatever umbrella you want to put it under, but it just kind of dismisses the dignity of individual traits of people. Not everybody that comes from a third world culture is in poverty and is lacking education. There are several students that I've worked with over the years that have come from wealth in from Mexico, Ecuador, Cuba, Colombia, who are looked upon as, there's an expectation that they should be poor. There's one student in particular that I'm thinking of from Chile, who at the age of 16 traveled Europe, backpacked around Europe, came from a wealthy family, was very knowledgeable about the world and education and stuff, and his teacher just had this stereotype that all Hispanics are poor. And so she treated him as if he was this disadvantaged soul. And he didn't like the communication that was being received to him. And then later she was asking him questions, and he was answering the questions, but didn't like where this was going. And basically by the end of the Q&A session that they were having, she got frustrated with his answers and then finally asked him if his home had dirt floors. Well, he became very indignant and cut off everybody from school, except a selected few who he had learned to trust. And so when we would talk, you know, he told me, people here just think that because I'm a Chilean, because I'm Latino, that I should be poor. So that kind of blanket all pattern that you give any people will always be an egregious error. And it's something that, you know, you need to be conscious about. Now, one of the things that becomes very frustrating as a Latino or as an Hispanic is, you know, what you call yourself. There are, the word Latino or Hispanic has no agreement with the different researchers as to where it came from. I've read several books, several articles, talked to many people to find out where Latino and Hispanic come from and what it means and what's the difference between the two. And this also confuses a lot of people who are not Hispanic because they want to be considerate, they want to be appropriate and use the right terminology when referring to a group of people. And basically, it just comes down to what is the word being used in your environment. In Texas, basically it's Hispanic. In New York, it's mostly Latino. In Florida, it's Hispanic and Latino, depending on where you are in Florida. But people can become very defensive over those terms because of what they believe they came from. The term Chicano is generally associated with a much more political or much more rebellious group of Hispanics. But somebody had told me, or I read somewhere, that Chicano comes from an Indian culture, the Chicales, or Chicaleas. And then somebody else said, no, that's not true. And there was a research on how Chicano actually came from some sort of other group somewhere else. But in short, if you're ever wondering which word to use, ask your audience. When you ask students, it's like, do you consider yourself a Latino or a Hispanic? And just have this very generic acceptance for whatever the term is appropriate. And discuss that, you know, names do affect people, and they do affect how people see themselves. But at the same time, you just kind of accept what is the norm that everybody else has. There are some other labels for Hispanics, and it causes a lot of division within the Hispanic community. Just a few really quickly is you have Hispanic Americans, Americans of Hispanic origin, Latin Americans living in the United States, immigrants, U.S. residents, U.S. citizen born of Havana, illegal alien, undocumented resident, underdocumented resident, mestizo, white Hispanic, black Hispanic, African American Hispanic. And people get caught up in this labeling business, and I emphasize this only because I have seen the effects of how it affects a group. Usually people don't give this much importance, but when you speak to students and when you speak to adults, suddenly it becomes more important than we realize many times within the group. There are many things that when people come from another country to this country that are unknown, likewise as when we travel to other countries, the things need to be explained. As far as education is concerned, parents many times do not understand that there are laws about attendance, you know, and they don't understand what the difference between an excused absence and a unexcused absence. And so that kind of gets commingled in the mix, and many times if the parents don't speak English and the child is the translator, what happens is then the child tells the parent many times what they want the parents to hear. So that becomes a very concerning issue. The best thing to do when there's registration is to explain all these things. Now, forgive me if this sounds like a cheap commercial break, but in the video I produced, Welcome to U.S. Schools, there is a, I discuss all these things that I feel schools need to discuss on the very first day. This is, you know, what are the laws about attendance? What's the difference between excused and unexcused? What you need to, you know, understand that is unique to your school. But one of the things that I didn't understand until about 3 years ago was that some schools in Spanish-speaking countries grade on a 10-point scale. So a child's grade can be anywhere between 0 and 10. Well, here we have a 100-point scale. And so there are actual cases where kids went home with a report card grade of a 50, and the parent thought the kid was doing absolutely outstanding because that must be the grading scale here. And the students, you know, being the deliverer of information, led the parents to believe that was so. So some parents never even knew what was happening within the school system. Even though the information was going home, it was not understood under the terms that it needed to be understood. There's also a lot of fear when you are working with your underdocumented or illegal residents in the United States. There is a culture of silence. You have parents who have trained their kids to not say much, to not say anything, don't get any attention, we don't want anybody to know that we're here. And so there is this undercurrent of constant bowing your head, which is very concerning for students, because when they enter the school, we tell them, you know, please ask questions, you know, advocate for yourself. If you don't understand something, you know, stay after school. And the need to be silent takes on so many different forms for students. You know, there was several incidences where kids have gotten the honor roll and their names were announced over the intercom, you know, in congratulatory veins. But the thing is, when their name was being announced, all they heard was in their head was how their parents told them to keep quiet and not get any attention. Well, some kids never got on the honor roll again, you know, for that reason. That's not to say that we shouldn't celebrate them, but parents need to understand that what happens under the roof of a school is not connected with immigration, is not connected with that any kind of deportation type process, and that would really help a lot. And it's hard, you know, we are not allowed to ask people, you know, are you here legally or not? So it's just the kind of generic information giving at a school that needs to say, we celebrate who you are, we're glad you're here, and, you know, making those kind of physical acknowledgments, having kids read out loud and standing up in class. A lot of the nonverbal, let me hear your voice type stuff, you know, where kids stand in school or they get recognized or they stand up at lunch and they do a performance. There's got to be a lot of things to counteract the need to not get attention. Many times a very, very strong art program where it's the music. In elementary school, your art program is your football team. And that is where kids first start to develop their social skills. So it's really more important in elementary many times for kids to have this experience of being verbal and vocal and being seen and having their name on bulletin boards and stuff, so that it just kind of counters that need to bow your head.
The number of participants in the conference has been increased.
And so that type of thing is really needed. There was a high school that I was working with kids. There was a class, a social studies class. They were refusing to speak in English. They were just kind of taking over the class, and they took this, you know, we're brown, we're proud, we're here type attitude. And so the principal called me in and said, you know, would you please work with this? There was actually three classes. And what was happening was the kids did not feel as if they were being accepted for who they were culturally by the school themselves. So they, in that need to survive, we all will go to that part of our brain that insists on survival. And so the part that they went to was, we're going to be speaking Spanish and be culturally Hispanic, you know, on steroids. Because the critical mass or the feeling around the school in, by their perception, was so anti-Hispanic. Well, it was not so much anti-Hispanic as it was pro-education, pro-certain things that were very important, but it wasn't culturally being communicated to them very well. And so I stepped in and talked about the different parts of confusion or conflicts within becoming an American citizen or whatever. One of the things that I had to do was start defining terms so that everybody knew, so that when we spoke, we had similar vocabulary going on. For example, we talked about the difference between being a migrant and an immigrant and assimilation and association. And then they were allowed to discuss, you know, what those terms meant to them, how they experienced these things, and they spoke very, very freely. One of the interesting things that happened in that class is halfway through my working with all three of these classes was I sat them down in a circle. And what was fascinating was behaviors within the classroom shifted for the better immediately. At first, they were in that stereotypical classroom setting where the desks were facing forward and the teacher was looking at the students. And when I worked with them on the days that I got there, if the classes were very big, I had half the class face the other half. And just that I see your face, I see everybody's face, became really pivotal in how everybody related to each other. So seeing each other was very, 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 very different. But it also, what I noticed also is that if there was a certain teacher with them who they felt as adversarial, they would gang up against her. But if the person leading the class, like when I was there, or another teacher that I worked with as well, when they felt that teacher was an ally, there was this coming together of the minds and working with each other, and the sensitivity was much stronger. One time I asked them a question. We did this group therapy type thing, basically just to calm down some tempers that were occurring. This is the classes that refused to speak in English. And I said, I wanted you to tell me something. I'm going to ask you some questions, and we may take several class sessions, because I went on Wednesdays only. And what I said was, I want you to tell me, where were you born? And out of the three classes, I only had three of them that were born in the United States. I said, how old were you when you got here, if indeed you were born somewhere else? Give me one strong memory from where you came from. And if you went to school from your home country, compare it to this school and tell me which one you like better. And where would you prefer to live? Well, what I found fascinating in three classes, if I was doing qualitative research, and what was interesting was I got a whole bunch of very emotional, very profound responses from everybody. Because what they also said towards the end was this was the first time they got to talk about their lives. They never discussed their migration process. They never discussed how they came over. Some were illegal, some were not. But they were never able to be themselves or reveal themselves. And that consistent mask that they had to wear caused so many problems socially and academically. They felt so much pressure to not be themselves that it became a impossible task to assimilate or associate. Acculturate, rather, sorry. But one thing that was fascinating to me is that 50%, and I did a count at some point, 50% of the students said they would prefer living where they came from, while the other 50% said they preferred living here. However, almost every single one down the line preferred the school setting in their home country. And when you really stop and think about it, it isn't the children that decide to come here. It's the adults. So children have to deal with the decisions made by the adults. And so there's this kind of rebellious or I have no power, you know, type reaction many times, as I discovered, or as we discovered. Part of the reason that the kids preferred the schools in other countries was they said, you know, here we have so many rules. You get in trouble for everything. You can't do anything without getting in trouble. And over there, we don't have that many rules, and everybody behaves. And so then I had to talk about how the fact that compulsory education in the United States looks very different from, you know, people who volunteer to go, and where not everybody is expected to go or has to go. Well, in Mexico, it is compulsory education. By law, everybody must attend. However, that law is not enforced. And so you have a lot of kids that don't go to school, and nobody gets in trouble or gets fined for it. Well, it's become much more stringent over here. And so that seems like this very cold reality, very harsh. There, I'm looking through my notes to find some. There's a difference between acculturation and assimilation. And depending on the dictionary you look at, those terms become very similar. So for the purpose of this talk, let me just go ahead and define it so that everybody's on the same page with definitions. Assimilation is when you completely abandon your past and you take on the norms and of the group that you're now in. So if you come to the United States, you're no longer a Chilean, you're no longer a Puerto Rican, you've totally denounced your past. And so assimilation has become a very dirty word in some parts of the country because it just means that who you are, who you were is not important, it's who you're going to become. Acculturation, for the purpose of this workshop, we're going to use as adapting both your past, your present, and your future, and becoming all of that within yourself and accepting everything you're from. So the acculturation is more of the process that where schools have been successful. When schools have this hidden curriculum that says you have got to acculturate, forget your past, stop speaking Spanish, stop being who you were, you need to project a better image for yourself. When it's that kind of climate within the school, you generally have a much higher dropout rate. You have many more behavioral problems. You have parents who feel they do not belong in the school setting. And so if you really take into the mindset of what are we saying to our community that is to acculturate rather than to assimilate, you know, you get a lot more bang for your buck that way. We have a question here. It says, what are the unintentional obstacles that a school may present to our Hispanic community? Well, part of it is that everybody can read English. And, you know, many times our handouts that go home or our communication needs to be in their native language as well. So translators are really important. Another unintentional obstacle that we don't realize many times is when we use children as translators. That is really something that needs to not happen at school. And let me explain as to why. When children translate for their parents and their parents don't speak English, what happens is it's called parentification. It's when children become parents to the adults. They become overly responsible. They've got to be the bearers of good and bad news. They translate for medical emergencies. They translate for the utilities people. They translate for, you know, for anybody and everybody. Well, you know, when you have kids who are, you know, 6, 7, 12 years old, translating for parents in these moments where adults need to be responsible and take the lead, what happens is the kids start to become the parent's parent. And it is not uncommon for us to see the kids, these same children, to go to high school and have years now of being the parent's parent and then not expecting to follow anybody's rules except the ones they make for themselves, because now they become adults. I've had many, many students, particularly boys, who the mothers come to school, they don't speak Spanish, the child is translating, and I've caught them in mistranslations or not fully translating information. And when I say something to the sons or daughters and say, you didn't tell your mother this part, you know, they will speak as an adult usually and say something like, well, I already know how they're going to react to this, so I didn't say that part because that's not going to be good for them, or they don't need to know this part. You know, there's almost this protection type thing as well. There's a layer of protection in all that communication as well. I was working with one kid who's a middle school child. It happened when he was in middle school. I worked with him when he was in high school. When he was in middle school, his father was killed, and he had to translate for the police and for the morgue and for the hospital. As a result, he was in high school, and he was completely checked out because his father was not in the best of standings with the community, and he had no idea. And after the police investigation reports came in, it turned out that he was involved with some sort of drug dealing, and the son never knew. Well, when the police told the son or asked the son some questions, he felt like this was horrific information and didn't share it with the mother. Well, the mother knew about some of it, but not all of it. But she never got that information from the son, so she didn't know that the police knew what they knew. And so for 2 or 3 years, he had been harboring this information privately and never told anyone. And it's a similar process that kids go through when they have to protect their parents. So many times, one of the things that schools need to do is provide translators or to communicate to the parents that they need to bring someone they trust, another relative or a friend, who can translate for them, but avoid using children as translators at all costs. Another question is, how can we help our Hispanic parents to understand the value of their first language in helping their children learn English as their second language? By accepting it. I think it's, for the most part, it's just having that Spanish translation of memos and stuff, but also outright saying that, you know, you are a third culture person. Let me explain third culture. Just realized I hadn't spoken on that. Third culture is research that was originally done with children of missionary workers. What would happen is missionaries would go around the world. They would travel with their children or have children abroad. And when they would return to the United States, what happened to the children many times is because their growing up years, the developmental years, involved two different countries, two different philosophies of government. Religion was seen different. Family was seen different. It was defined differently in the different places they were. They belonged in both places simultaneously, belonging nowhere. They neither considered themselves Americans nor whatever they were from, or they identified with only one and not the other. So consequently, they didn't like half of who they were, or they were just bewildered by half of who they were. Well, our children are very much the same way, and so are our parents. When children come, let's say, from Guatemala, and they get here at the age of 7, they have a very strong identity of themselves, but then they enter this American system, and they start to develop new norms and values. And there is this in-between state of, I am neither Guatemalan nor am I American, I'm both, but Americans don't consider me American, they consider me a Guatemalan. And I go to Guatemala and I no longer speak Spanish the way I did, now I have an accent, I don't have the fluency I did, so they consider me an American. So you start to define yourselves by your others. Your surroundings treats you more as a visitor or as somebody who doesn't really belong the way other people who are natives and have been here forever belong. So you belong, but you belong differently. And so there's a lot of that going on. So many times what I have done with students and parents is said, you know, there is a third culture reality. The need for people to be comfortable in both is important so that you can operate and function in both. You know, I usually acknowledge the fact that I am a Mexican American. And when it is not uncommon for me to be in a room and have people who are non-Hispanic go, why do Hispanics do this? You know, or is it true that in the Hispanic culture, you know, as if I'm some sort of Hispanic encyclopedia? And it's just funny because many times I sit there and go, I don't know. Conversely, when I go to Mexico and vacation, because and people hear me speak, they go, ah, tú eres americano. You know, you're an American. And so there is this kind of a ha-ha attitude that it is true. You live between two worlds. And so however that is communicated to the parents, through acceptance, through art, sometimes, you know, presentations or lectures, or the kind of carnivals, you know, festivities, music, you know, it's all the above. It isn't one piece. Let me try to see if we have any more questions.
Ruben, would you like to address some of the other questions that have come in?
I've only got one other one. Which do you have one?
I have a couple more that have come in.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, Kathleen asked, how do we address the early signs of gang awareness involvement in a K-4 school? And she says they're 41% Hispanic.
Oh, gang awareness. Interesting. Gang awareness is very concerning within the Hispanic community because, that's any community, not just Hispanic. But part of it is it's a telltale sign that there are places I don't belong, but I belong in the gang. The gang accepted me for who I am, and probably I am not being successful in school, socially, academically, or both. So how do you work with that? Many times is you strengthen your tutoring programs, you strengthen presentations. We have, as a matter of fact, I'm working with an elementary school this year, and they asked me to mentor 5 fifth grade boys. 3 of them showed very strong gang affiliations type stuff. Well, that's physical traits. When I talked to the boys, what I realized is they're much more inclined to appreciate labor than they are academics. So making them read more and making them, you know, do all the academics more was not the channel by which to go. We had an atrium. And so what I did was I spent 2 Saturdays, and we completely redid the atrium. We labored over it, but we did math skills. We said we're going to retile the sidewalk in the atrium. We're going to study which plants are better in the sun and better in the shade. But it was hands-on. It was Mother Earth. It was a lot of labor. It was a lot of sweat, I mean physical sweat. And on the days that we were working on the atrium, you know, I was a strict boss. I said, you got to get to work. You got to dig that hole. And, you know, and these poor little fifth grade bodies were not big enough to handle, you know, the tile we were doing and stuff. But it became a very concrete physical activity. Well, that also improved the appearance of the school. Well, every day when they went to lunch, they passed by the atrium and they were seeing the results of their work and the plants were growing. And I got to discuss that type of tie-in with them. Long story short, the standardized test in Texas is called the TACS, T-A-K-S, Texas Assessment of Skills and Knowledge, Knowledge and Skills. And one of the kids, for the very first time, passed the TACS test. He'd just never done it. But he never had an emotional or visceral buy-in to the environment of school. Many times your gang members have accents. And I discuss through literature, the stories that we read, you know, what it means to feel to belong. We also talk to the families. and say, we just want you to know that these are the kind of things that we're seeing, and how can we help? How can we work together? Talking to the kids through the counselors, you know, counselors are very important in this moment in time as well, and just seeing what are their interests and how can their interests be utilized in the academic setting, in the academic environment. I hope that helps.
Okay. Ruben, we have a couple more questions that have come in.
Okay.
How do you engage parents to attend sessions explaining the benefits of post-secondary education as well as financial aid in a poor urban setting where the priority is work?
Forgive me if, again, I'm going to sound, this is in my video as well. I don't mean to be pushing my video like some sort of cheap vendor, but in the video that I've put out, it's in Spanish with English subtitles, but it discusses how we have a lot of kids, our culture is much, many times, centered around labor. When you come from a third world culture, you tend to work, not study, more than anything else. And one of the things that happens is we have our youth who grow up very, very fast. There is no such thing as a teenager by the American definition in other countries. America is the only country I know of where we say to children at a very young age, well, you're 11 years old right now, but when you're 13, you're going to be difficult, you're going to be hormonal, you're going to talk back, you're going to be rude. And that doesn't happen in other cultures. So part of what happens to when work is being valued, there's a subconscious thread that kids don't have time to get in trouble or be mean or talk back if they're working, if they're being productive. And if they're not working, then, you know, then they have this teenager-type mentality. So that question really becomes multi-layered. But one of the things that needs to happen is when we talk to parents, what we tell them is their job in the United States is school. That is their work. That is something they need to be active with because it improves their adult lives. We'll say that, you know, culturally, many times boys and girls want to start working at a younger age because in the countries they come from, at the age of 4, you can shine shoes. You can sell, you know, chiclets, you know, gum on the street. You can be a significant financial contributor to the household. Well, that doesn't, the need or the practice doesn't necessarily terminate just because you left the country. Your understanding of life as to who you are. So it's that constant discussion with parents, and many times what I'll do is I'll have a parent meeting. Well, to get them there within elementary school, I'll say have an arts program and have the kids perform something and then have them go somewhere else in the school while you have a meeting with the parents who did attend. You get bigger attendance that way. In the middle school and high schools, you can have a museum walk of the kids' work. You can say the kids are going to present something, and instead of being on stage, you know, they present in their classrooms, they can do small group activities or something, and then the students go away, and then you talk to the parents about it. But then you have the parents analyze, you know, what is it you want for your child? Where do you want them to be in the next 5 years? You know, we obviously, you know, would like as many to get to go to college. Many times I present the actual research. You know, I get the data from the internet, from the census, that says this is how many Hispanics are going to college, and it's only 10%. How do we get more? You know, why do you think, you know, and put the onus back on the parents. Generally, those kind of conversations are very, very strong. And if you can find stronger voices in the Hispanic community, stronger parents who are much more vocal, don't keep their head down, and are pro-education, to be in charge of the phone trees, to call, to advertise, and many times going house to house. Unfortunately, because many, many, many Hispanics do not have an education, have not gotten a high school diploma, school is very intimidating. It's a very frightening place to be, emotionally and socially. So if you know, knocking on doors, literally, and saying, we're going to have a meeting coming over here, you know, and getting a parent volunteers to help do that would be wonderful. Having a dinner you know, saying, you know, having people bring a plate of food, you know, a cultural night or a Hispanic night, you know, that type of stuff really helps get involved within the centrifugal force of that. Can you do another question?
Yes, one more. Let's see. Poorly prepared Latino Hispanics keep arriving at the community college to start a career occupation. When they find the gap they most overcome to tackle college-level courses, they get discouraged and would rather not do it. What suggestions do you have to guide them to overcome this mindset? And is this the same for traditional and non-traditional students?
It is the same for the most part. I mean, colleges have a 50% dropout rate as it is, if you just take out the Hispanic element. But when you have a high percentage of Hispanics, particularly that are dropping out, many times what you can start is a Hispanic organization, and there's a lot of colleges that are now starting to connect to the local high schools. They are doing programs or reach-out programs. They are doing, you know, a lot of tutoring. There's also a need many times for just a social outlet for a Hispanic group. Because of that, a lot of Hispanics go to colleges, many times they're not surrounded by like-minded or like-culture people. And so it becomes very intimidating because you almost, the feeling is, I don't belong here. You know, and so it becomes this need for socializing and academic support. The stereotypical entrance into college is that you are thrown into college and you survive on your own and it's baptism by fire. Well, we have an immense amount of Hispanics who don't go home to educated parents to get the continued support and conversations that a lot of non-Hispanics have. You know, I mean, the research shows that if your parents went to college, more than likely you are going to college. Well, inverse, if your parents didn't go to college, more than likely you aren't either. And so you don't have anywhere to go for that added support. One kid I was working with signed up for college. He was very, very proud, and he said, "Dad, I'm going to college." He was going to be the first one in his family. And when he told his father, he said, "I'm going to take 12 hours. I have 12 hours worth of classes that I'm signing up for." Well, the father thought it was stupid. He wanted him to drop out of college. He said, "Why are you going for 12 hours?" Well, he translated 12 hours in the same way people translate hours for a part-time job. So he thought he's working. He was thinking he's going to be working less than 20 hours a week. Well, how dumb is that? Not realizing 12 hours is a full load. And so that kind of not knowing was very discouraging for him. And so he almost dropped out before the whole thing started. I had to go explain to the father what 12 hours is. And it was through conversation that I realized he was thinking of job terms and job vocabulary and didn't understand how that works. So many times having things start in high school or middle school where colleges actually come to visit, talk about the different things they can do, the different supports that exist, you know, that type of stuff really makes a very big difference in your retention. Also, a mentoring program, you have people who are students in the school who adapt a freshman that come in and, you know, tag along with one person. If you have any questions, this is the person you go to. This is somebody that you can talk to for as the year unfolds, as you have to register for new classes. You know, somebody that can hold your hand along the way, and eventually you can do it on your own as well. Also, many times is having a four-year plan or a two-year plan if it's a junior college where the classes are done for you. You don't have to make a different schedule every time on your own. In poverty, for the most part, the more choices you give someone, the more failure you have. And that, I don't have the time to go into that conversation, but for the most part, giving less choices is really much more important for people in poverty or who have less education. And Nick, any more questions?
Yes, I have a couple more that have come in. And you addressed this a little bit earlier, but let's go ahead. So it's working with Spanish-speaking families, are there identifiable consistent barriers when working with families in the home? And if so, what are some techniques or strategies to overcome those barriers?
Could you ask that question again, please?
Sure. Working with Spanish-speaking families, are there identifiable consistent barriers when working with families in the home?
I think the biggest barrier that comes to mind right now is just the insecurities that parents have in working with schools, especially when they, you know, I spoke to a parent group one night, and I said, you know, this school is 60% Hispanic, but the volunteers are mostly non-Hispanic. I said the message the kids get is that Hispanics don't volunteer. You know, Hispanics don't get involved. Hispanics don't speak. And I said that non-judgmentally. I just said, you know, if you think about the view of a child and how they see the world, if they see that, you know, there's predominantly brown around here, but it's non-brown that's doing all the work, then what that says to the kid is brown doesn't belong in school. And it was that type of loving yet fierce conversation, to quote a book, that I had with the parents that they got them thinking and said, you know, we really need your children to feel much more comfortable with the school, and we really need you here with us. You know, could you help out in, you know, certain ways, or, you know, show up for these events? And we got many more Hispanic parents coming. There was another one that, you know, on the much more positive spin, during the arts program, the music program, I had parent volunteers come in for things that were non-academic. They were not reading the book to a kid. They were not doing bulletin boards. You know, they were cutting, they were pasting, they were doing some other things. And then we kind of slowly segued them into doing other things that were much more, you know, academic. So it just depends on what is available at your school. And you have to stop and think, how are we non-verbally communicating to our community?
Okay, Ruben, I have one more question that's come in, and then we'll wrap up in a minute. This is from Marcy. She says, I'm working with a local nonprofit, and we are setting up a community center in a low-income neighborhood consisting of primarily Hispanic and Black residents. What advice or suggestions do you have for an initial approach to welcome the residents, to determine their needs, and to create a sense of community among both cultures?
Probably a lot of physical stuff at first. If you're familiar with ROPES, ROPES has a lot of really neat team building activities, you know, the human knot, lots of thinking, lots of rushing, field day type stuff where you just kind of, there's a lot of physicalness to it. And then after the physicalness, after the concrete examples of working together, being together, you know, bringing food, cooking together, et cetera, then later discussing about, you know, how wonderful it is that people are able to do this, you know, and this is exactly where we want the world to be. There's many different approaches. When it comes to diversity, you know, it becomes, it's a great thought, it's a very difficult practice. When it becomes the prime directive to celebrate diversity, it becomes, generally it falls, where it falls short with many groups is where they over-talk it or they overthink it instead of do it. And so it's in the doing that helps bring people together more so, and then the appreciation afterwards. The other thing is to avoid conversations where you allow people to say things like, this is what Black people do, this is what Hispanic people do. And I know this workshop flies in the face of that, but it's allowing for the, you know, this is what is common as opposed to this is what we do. And just talk about, you know, individual realities as well. Keeping, and I don't know what direction this community center is in, but if it's going to be a lot of conversations or a lot of group meetings, you know, take the 12-step program type conversation rules where there's no crosstalk. You don't say, I don't like what you said. You keep it in the eye. You know, when I hear this, I feel this. and just have certain rules that allow for the autonomy of the individual without overstepping on someone else's. Are there any more questions?
Okay, I am looking. Let's see. I just had a couple more come through. Please provide additional practice we can immediately implement to help bridge the gap between Hispanic families and American educational system.
Repeat that one more time, please.
Please provide additional practices we can immediately implement to help bridge the gap between Hispanic families and the American educational system.
What I have found most effective with kids is having a curriculum that promotes language development. I don't care, and in high school, it's harder to convince the entire school to do this for non-language teachers. When your entire curriculum really centers around language development, it's not just going to social studies, it's obtaining the language of it. And it's speaking in front of the class, it's presenting, it's inviting your parents. The other thing that I forgot to mention earlier is one technique to get parents to a school meeting is to not have a memo, you can have a memo that's given to the classes, but then have the students write it in their own handwriting. Dear Mom and Dad, you know, there's a meeting coming. I would really like for you to come to this meeting. We're going to be doing this. Immediate practices. Using a lot of cooperative groups, but in small numbers, not in large numbers, are generally much, much better immediately. Having kids talk to a partner during a lesson. One thing that I found very effective is that I forget what it's called, but the teacher talks for 10 minutes, and then you say, okay, talk to your partner for the next 2 minutes and review what I just said. And having them give them voice, visual, verbal, physical, you know, that type of exposure to constant language, so that where they're speaking English or where they're asked to speak English becomes a place where they are where they're actually doing it and where they're actually using their English more. Because if they're only going to socialize at school, if they're not going to speak very much while in their seat, then they really never start practicing English in the setting they need to practice it in. So they socialize in Spanish. They go to cafeteria, they go between classes, they go after school, and it's all within social settings. But if you have them talking during the academic day about what you just said and use their English, it really helps in the transference of feeling part of the culture. Okay?
Hey, Ruben, one more came in.
Okay.
This
I love the question.
This is from Jeanette. How do you encourage students in high school who feel that they have no future since they cannot go to college because they do not have a social security number?
There is no answer there. There are several organizations that I'm just now hearing about. Nobody's given me a name, and I'm doing the research myself to figure out who they are. That is a heartbreaking question. I do not know the answer there. Wish I did. I have several kids who have said that to me, and all I've said to them and their family is, what are you doing to get one? What are you doing to become legal? I have the name of an attorney in Laredo, Texas, who is above board. There's a lot of people who take advantage of illegal immigrants, and take their money and for years on end say, we need $400 more, we need $2,000 more, we need $300 more, and we need the next process, the next step. Well, a lot of people's their financial resources are drained dry on scams on how to become legal. So and schools cannot get involved with that in all truth. So it becomes a real hard bridge to cross, other than given names of people that I say, like, here's somebody who I've heard is trustworthy, you know, or I can't say much. And I'll say, you may want to call this person. But they have to get a Social Security number. You know, the system is not friendly otherwise at this moment in time. Are there any more?
Okay, Ruben, that's all the questions that I've had come in. If you want to wrap up or if you had a closing remark.
Okay, well, there's one question I got that I have not answered. And
okay.
How is it in, why, how important is it to take cultural norms into account? You know, why is it important? So let me just sum up with saying this. When we have students in the United States who travel abroad, people who work for Schlumberger or any kind of other company, and they go to a school in a foreign country, and I've known some, there is a cultural shock. There is a mourning process that our kids go through. And usually they come home and they have a English-speaking parent with plenty of resources, who's hardworking, who is also educated. And it takes a lot for our students, American-born students, to get over the hump of accepting where they are now, having said goodbye to their friends, and becoming one with who they are. And that's with kids who have those resources available to them. However, when we have kids that come over here and parents who work 2 and 3 jobs, which is not uncommon, and the parents themselves don't understand how to assimilate or associate or acculturate, rather, they are having their own struggles, and they cannot impart, you know, much wisdom to their kids other than just survive day to day as best you can, honey. That's very difficult. That's a very difficult reality for many of our students. So schools many times need to be that resource, need to be the place where they can discuss those realities, because they're not going home and having those conversations. You know, having a cultural club is something that has honestly helped very much. However, my experience has been that I've seen a lot of cultural clubs develop more out of pity than out of empowerment. And so the clubs become this catch-all of everybody who feels like a misfit of a certain color, religion, race, size, whatever. And so it needs to have a very strong focus, very academically and socially demanding. It is a place of acceptance. It is a place of learning. And it's all empowering. So there's everybody needs a place they belong. And when somebody within any group finds a place they don't belong, they will go wherever they feel they can belong, or they will be accepted for who they are. And whether that be gangs or church or school or a job, people will migrate where they can finally take a deep breath. And so my message is that help the kids take a deep breath and feel comfortable where they're at. And one of the biggest ways as well is to understand who you are as an individual. I've said this many, many times. It wasn't really until I understood my culture, I am Hispanic, it wasn't really until I understood my culture and appreciated my culture, you know, so deeply that I honestly got to appreciate everybody else's. You know, when I stopped being so critical of my, this is a long story, but when I was not in a need to judge cultures, I was in a place of acceptance. It was amazing to me how much more peaceful I was with everybody else. So kumbaya.
Okay, thanks, Ruben. Ruben has mentioned today the DVD, Welcome to U.S. Schools, A Guide for Spanish-Speaking Immigrant Parents. And we do want to offer you, for participating in the teleseminar today, we want to offer you a special rate on that DVD. Between now and Friday, we are offering 25% off of the DVD, which is normally $97, so you would get it for $72.75, plus $6.50 shipping. You will need to, if you would like to take advantage of the promotional offer, you may either fax an order in or call us at our main office. The number at the office is 800-424-9484, and whoever answers the phone there then can help you place that order. Or you may fax an order to us at 281-426-8705. If you would like to pay with your school district purchase order, you can fax that purchase order with your order. Thank you again for attending the seminar today. The next seminar is scheduled for July 29th with Bill Summers. and you should be receiving emails about that. Thank you again for your participation today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. Bye, everybody.